Support for KNKX and Sound Effect comes from WSECU, reminding listeners that WSECU is a local community credit union. WSECU welcomes everyone in the state of Washington who embraces the values of giving, sharing, and supporting local communities. More information can be found at WSECU.org.
What do you love about information?
Facts can often be their own reward. You know, if you're a connoisseur, there's an aesthetic involved. You want the beautiful fact, the little piece of trivia that'll make people set down their glass and say, I didn't know that. But really what's most rewarding is when you can actually use it in real life.
Give a few examples.
Well, if you can arrange to be on a major syndicated quiz show for 6 months, you might be able to pay for your house by knowing Rutherford Hayes' middle name.
By the way, this is Sound Effect, and I'm Jennifer Wing, and you're probably wondering who I'm talking to. Well, here's a clue. The man who won 74 times in a row on Jeopardy and is the second highest earner in game show history with a total of more than $3 million. If you answered, who is Ken Jennings, who happens to live in Seattle, you are correct. Ken says knowing a lot of random facts comes in really handy to bring people together, to connect with total strangers.
People love it when you know something about their job or their hometown or their alma mater. It creates a connection. It's like you got to know them before you even met.
How do you go about collecting information and storing it in your memory?
I'm not Data from Star Trek. Describe your information gathering tasks, Ken. I would say for most know-it-all types, it's a pretty organic process. They're not sitting on the John with a copy of the Britannica. You know how it's very easy to remember stuff you're interested in? Even a kid who can't learn his times tables, he knows all the words of the song he likes, or she knows all the players on her favorite team or whatever. You don't have to try to learn stuff that's interesting, right? And so for people who know a lot of stuff, they're just curious about everything.
In this world of information, there's so many different portals and different ways to access facts or alternative facts now.
Right.
Do you ever feel overwhelmed by information, by too much information?
I feel like personally I'm a gourmand, you know, the more the better. But I don't think it's been a net good for our society. Not because of the capacity in our heads. It's not like if you learn all the Real Housewives, you're going to forget your state capitals. Like, that's not how memory works. I often think, you know, the fact that there is so much more out there to be engaged in is probably good for our brains. But I just mean the fact that to make informed decisions in our society now, there's so much complexity that, you know, the man on the street or woman on the street just can't do it anymore. Recently, I've seen people with very strong opinions on the Trans-Pacific Partnership, both pro and con. And I'm thinking, you are 19 years old and not an economist. You have no idea whether the TPP should be signed or not. And yet you have the fury of a thousand suns on this issue. And I think that's our country now. People whose passion about an issue is inversely proportional to their knowledge about it. That's a problem in democracy, by the way. I'm not advocating for a totalitarian government run by a small group of trivia-loving elites, but I don't know what the solution is.
Too much information is dangerous, you're saying.
I think too much information leads to too much complexity and, yeah, a populace that cannot be informed about the issues that are actually meaningful to their lives.
Too much information. This is what the show is about today. Sometimes people share more than we'd like. Sometimes collecting information can be a physically painful process. And where does all of the stuff we see on our screens, where does it come from? Really, how does the plumbing of the internet work? These stories and more just ahead on Sound Effect. So, the internet. Do you know how that TV show that you're currently binge watching or the photos that you just emailed to your aunt in Michigan, do you know how all of that information gets around? Well, 88.5's Will James joins us in the studio to tell us about a small town in Washington State that plays a pretty big role in the digital highway. Will, where is this place and what exactly did you learn?
It's Quincy, Washington. It was basically a conventional Northwest farm town east of the mountains until companies like Microsoft started building these giant data centers there.
What's a data center?
Picture a warehouse filled with the internet. Quincy has become like a hub of these things, and it's changed the town in a lot of ways. I had to see one of these things, and the first time I did, I was standing in the kitchen of a woman named Patty Martin.
That's Microsoft. And beyond it, you can't see it now because of the tree, but Dell is right beyond Microsoft.
They're data centers, storehouses of electronic information. Patty lives in Quincy, a city that sits in a bowl of gentle hills rising from the plain of eastern Washington. Quincy was once known for food processing plants that got stuff like frozen fruit and snap peas ready for the supermarket. That is, until these centers started rising from the farm fields 10 years ago.
What did this view from your kitchen window used to be?
Well, there used to be trees, and I suspect they took the trees down because there are power lines that are right there, and you can't have any outages, right?
You can't have any outages because inside buildings like this are canyons of humming computer servers that sustain an invisible universe of information, family photos, tax records. Patty has a history with these things, a quarrel that's about more than just the aesthetics of her backyard. But before we get to that, let's explain how a city with two stoplights sprouted six massive data centers, the physical manifestations of the digital storage space we think of as the cloud.
Yeah, there's not really a cloud, so to speak. I mean, but there is a cloud and it's here.
Jim Hemberry was on the city council about a decade ago when a consultant came to Quincy to talk about how to grow the economy.
You know, and somebody said, you know what, we need a Microsoft here, just as a joke. And lo and behold, they showed up.
It turned out Quincy had cheap and reliable electricity from the Columbia River and acres of empty farm fields ripe for development. And Quincy was safe. Tech companies didn't have to worry about an earthquake or a hurricane wiping out vast chunks of the internet. It was ideal for data centers, and the local government began marketing it that way. The state also passed a sales tax break for companies that built data centers there. Microsoft was the first to bite. And the rest followed.
Yeah, you know, if you use TurboTax, most likely it's stored over here at Intuit over here. You know, and Bing and Xbox 360, I don't know all those, but...
Jim is now Quincy's mayor. When I met him in his office, he was wearing jeans and a Seahawks polo shirt. He looked like a guy getting ready to retire, which he is at the end of the year. And in a way, he is retiring at the peak of his career. Quincy has made some serious money, thanks in large part to the data centers.
Our property tax revenue is about five times what it was before they built, and our sales tax revenue is about the same.
What has that allowed you to do as a city government?
Well, it's allowed us to do a lot of things.
He's happy to go through them.
We have done a lot of improvements in our parks, tennis courts, basketball courts, an amphitheater, a new animal shelter. The numbers of animals that are either adopted or fostered out of here is amazing. Then we built the new public services building. We went from 10 police officers to 20. Big toys.
Mayors dream of these kinds of projects, but few actually get the money to realize so many of them. And Quincy's residents are people who don't often get this level of public investment. Three quarters of the people who live here are Latino. Many are immigrants who work in farming or food processing. This is one of the poorest counties in Washington state. Let's go back to Patty. She used to be the mayor here back in the 90s, before the data centers were even a dream. But she spent much of the past 7 years filling her head and parts of her house with information about data centers.
It's a lot of stuff. If I showed you how many binders of papers and drawers of papers that I have.
Patty's thing is, she thinks all this growth comes at a cost. You see, all this information is hungry. It takes an unbroken flow of electricity to survive, and that has consequences. To show me what she means, Patty drives me to a cluster of data centers a few blocks from Quincy's main road.
All right, so this is Yahoo?
Yeah, this is Yahoo. So each one of those brown stacks is the stack on top of a diesel generator.
Each data center has diesel engines for backup power. They're tested periodically, and that creates exhaust. It's the same stuff that comes out of a diesel truck. Remember that digital cloud we were talking about? Patty says she's seen it, an actual cloud.
When you're driving into town, there'll be a pink haze that you can see from a distance, and that pink, kind of brownish, it's pinkish brown, is characteristically or classically diesel.
The state's Department of Ecology has signed off on 228 diesel engines in Quincy and tracks how often they run and how much pollution they release. The state says they're not a health risk. Microsoft and other companies say they take pains to build their data centers as green as possible. But this has not stopped Patty and a friend, Dana Del Porto, a retired teacher, from challenging most of those state permits. They do the legal work themselves, sometimes pulling all-nighters. And while they've never won, they've gotten the state to impose some pollution controls. Patty and her friend Dana are basically alone in this fight. Most people in town are either indifferent or they like the new signs of prosperity.
You know, some people are happy that, you know, now we've got a Shopko and they, you know, that's part of the development. Like Anytime Fitness is here, and there's some people that see growth as a good thing. I'm not opposed to growth. I just think that, you know, if you're going to have it, you need to put every protection that is available under the law in place to protect your constituents.
What she's basically asking for is more information about the consequences of storing all this information. We stop on a hill overlooking what is going to be Quincy's 7th data center once Microsoft switches it on. From up here, it looks like a plane of concrete, a gray slab that will one day pulse with information. Patty moved here in the 4th grade. Looking down at Quincy, she thinks about how it's changed.
It's looking much more industrial all the time. And I don't think anyone that moved to a rural location moved to live in an industrial complex, because that's what it looks like. It is an industrial complex now.
It was always a little industrial with the food processing.
Yeah, a little industrial, but this is not related to food processing. This is not related to agriculture. This is not related to any of what would have drawn somebody to a rural community.
Patty doesn't have a smartphone. She has Facebook and uses email, but she avoids saving information on the cloud. Instead, she uses an external hard drive. She says living alongside the cloud, seeing it as a bunch of buildings, makes it seem less of a safe, permanent place to store her photos and other stuff she cares about. It seems vulnerable. I ask her what she wants people to know about the data we create and store and think of as existing in some infinite digital realm. What she basically wants people to know is that it all ends up somewhere. Long after we forget about it, it's still taking up land and spewing exhaust in someone's town, outside someone's kitchen window.
That was 88.5's Will James. You're listening to Sound Effect on 88.5 KNKX. I'm Jennifer Wing, and today's theme is TMI. You know, too much information. And just a heads up, this next story contains information that is not okay for younger listeners. This story is about the very personal information you give over to doctors and police after you've been sexually assaulted. Most people call this a rape kit, although here in Washington, it's technically called a sexual assault kit. And that phrase, rape kit, it makes it sound like it's this neat, tidy little exam, a package. But the actual process is long, and it is difficult. Your body is a crime scene. The nurse scraping every part for evidence of assault. DNA, bruises, fingerprints, hair, dirt. Take Leah. She's a librarian here in Seattle, and we're not using her last name to protect her privacy. In April of 2014, Leah reported she was raped. She was out in Ballard with a close friend, and she decided to go to a neighborhood bar after her friend went home.
And while I was there, I had one beer and then one sip of a second beer. I had been talking to this guy who seemed like a totally normal man. I asked him to watch my drink and went to the restroom, thinking I was being responsible. I remember the bar closing and leaving. I remember telling him specifically that I did not want to have sex with him. And then I remember being in an apartment with my tights pulled around my ankles, bound. He said, "Hold on, I'm gonna get a towel." And I looked down and the bed that I was on was completely covered in blood.
So Leah manages to get herself out of the apartment. She calls her friend and gets home to safety, and she wakes up the next morning disoriented and really upset.
And when I went to the bathroom, I passed a fist-sized blood clot into the toilet and knew that something was very, very wrong. Still had very little idea of what had happened the night before. So I immediately got in my car and I drove down to Swedish Ballard.
But at Leah's local hospital, Swedish Ballard, there are no nurses trained to perform a sexual assault exam. So Leah has to go to Harborview Medical Center on Capitol Hill. Victims, they only have 120 hours after the assault to collect evidence.
When the exam started, they took all of my things and I watched them put all of my bloody underwear into another sack and examine it. They took swabs of every part of my body, the inside of my vagina, up into my cervix. They did an anal swab. They did swabs in my mouth. They then took photographs with a bright light shining onto my genitals. They took photographs of every single part of my body. And the worst part was that at the end, they have to take a photograph of your face. And to think that I had not slept in a long time. And I sat in that room for hours crying. And they take a picture of your face at the worst moment of your entire life. And that was the hardest part, knowing that there's this picture out there of my face at the worst moment of my life. I can't imagine looking at that picture. That is the picture of someone who's broken and who does not know if they're going to survive. And it's a photo of pure humiliation. I heard once a prosecutor say that the rape kit is the beginning of the healing process. And when I heard that quote, I just started laughing because the idea is so out of touch and absurd that all you can do is laugh at something like that. It is an exam that is degrading. It's necessary. I'm glad I did it, but it's not healing.
The rape kit may not be the first step in the healing process, but nurses, they're still trained to think of it that way.
If there's one thing you say to someone who's been assaulted is, "I'm sorry this has happened to you, how can I help you?"
That's Terry Stewart. She's the coordinator for the Sexual Assault Nurse Examiner Program at Harborview. She trains nurses how to deal with sexual assault patients.
On the general exam, we're primarily looking at the skin. Are there bruises? Are those bruises in a pattern, maybe? You know, does it look like a grip mark? The genital exam, I think most people in society think that if someone was sexually assaulted, they have to have had injuries to the genital area. And the truth is the majority of patients don't. But what the sexual assault nurses get trained on is much more of the finer details of the female, especially the female genital anatomy, that most people aren't trained to identify.
Where does all of the evidence, the blood, the swabs, the photos, where does it go? Terry says some hospitals will store it for up to 6 months, and then it's off to law enforcement.
And then it gets sent to the Washington State Crime Lab, and they test the evidence. None of the evidence is ever processed in any hospital in the state of Washington.
Leah's rape kit ultimately was tested, but it did not reveal DNA evidence of her assailant. And in fact, King County prosecutors, they decided not to press charges in her case. Despite Leah's fist-sized blood clot and the fact that a tox screen showed traces of a date rape drug in her system, they said they could not prove that the sex was non-consensual. Because of this experience, Leah now advocates for sexual assault survivors in Olympia, and she's seen some positive changes to how the system works. In 2015, the state legislature passed a law requiring that all rape kits be tested at a state crime lab within 30 days.
There are approximately 6,000 untested rape kits sitting in storage in Washington state. And because of this law, we will test them.
State representatives are working to fully fund this testing, as well as create cold case teams to follow up on results. Because in the end, getting all of this information does not necessarily mean more justice for survivors. Prosecutors and law enforcement still have the final say in carrying out investigations and legal action. For Leah, more information means there's less reason for society to look away.
And we need to make sure that every person who goes to an emergency room to get a rape kit is able to get one without worrying about cost or transportation or anything. We need to remove those barriers so that we can collect the empirical evidence that is needed to convict rapists.
In 2016, Washington State voted to create a system for rape survivors to track the status of their evidence. It is the first of its kind in the nation. If you're just joining us, our theme today on Sound Effect is too much information. Comedians, they share lots of information, personal information about their flaws and family members in order to generate laughs. Seattle's Scott Lossie is no different. It's a release for him to tell jokes like this one about his dad.
He's a weird dude. He's really religious, and I'm not very religious, and he knows I do stand-up, and he's supportive, but he refuses to watch me do it. Because in his words, I'm worried about all the swears.
Comedy often comes from pain. When Scott was a kid, he lost two older brothers, one from suicide, the other a car accident. More heartbreak would follow. Scott Lossie talks with 88.5's Ariel Van Cleve about how seeing a therapist led to him performing on stage. But before he sought professional help, Scott tells Ariel that these tragedies caused him to have anxiety that was so severe, he was almost incapable of ordering a pizza over the phone.
I'd be at home and my mom would be like, order a pizza. And I'm like, okay. And she's like, did you order it yet? I'm like, no, no, I didn't. And she's like, what? Go. And in my brain, I remember being like, okay, I'm gonna call. I'm gonna say it's for delivery. And then he's going to ask me what I want on it. There's going to be a crust. What size is the crust? And I'd call eventually, but it would be so painful. Like, all these horrible things happened in my life, but also I started to have these really weird feelings in my head. Like, I would have these headaches where I would, like, hallucinate, and then I'd come back and feel really sick. And it happened for, like, 2 years, which later I would get diagnosed with epilepsy when I was 20. So I was going into high school with, like, a broken head. Everybody's dying.
Right.
My family is not my family anymore.
Well, there was another event that happened with your mom.
Yeah.
You were how old when your mom passed away?
She passed away before Y2K. Because I remember thinking to myself, oh, at least she's not around for Y2K. And then nothing happened in Y2K.
So even in that moment, like, you're making light.
You don't have to deal with anything if you can make a joke about it. Or maybe you are dealing with it. Who knows? But yeah, I was 19.
How's your relationship with your dad?
Really bad.
Okay.
We had a falling out.
When?
Right after my mom died. After my mom passed away, there was a disagreement about some estate things, which ended in a unfortunate voicemail. But he was very upset, and he made the mistake of saying basically that I should pretend he's dead. And I was pretty hell-bent on letting him have his wish.
When you have all of these events that happen, you want to have someone to share this with.
I was living with my girlfriend at the time. Oh,
that's a lot for her to...
Yeah. Yeah. Like, it's a new relationship. And then I'm like, hey, seizure, dead mom, dad hates me. She'd encouraged me throughout. And I'm stubborn as hell. Like, I'm the most stubborn person.
But then finally you were like, okay, fine.
I was finally like,
fine.
Okay. Uh-huh. Maybe I haven't dealt with
anything.
Death, divorce, death.
Yeah.
This brain's broken. Okay.
So you wind up in therapy.
Yeah. So
and
I,
you're talking to this therapist. What was that like going in there and actually unburdening yourself?
I was freaked out.
Why?
Because I'd done a really good job of like holding everything inside and not sharing. Because I was like, he's going to want to, I'm going to have to tell him all my secrets. He wouldn't respond to when I told him stories. And it made me so mad. I wanted something. Because these are good, sad stories. They deserve, somebody should be like, oh man. But therapists don't say anything. So I made it my goal kind of to be funny. Like, oh, you know. Probably partially because I was uncomfortable, but partially because I was like, what the hell, man?
get on board.
So I would joke about it.
Mm-hmm.
I started to enjoy going like to this thing that I hate, that I just fought against.
Did you ever get a reaction out of him?
Yeah. One day I went in there and he's like, you know, you always like to say funny stuff. And I was like, yeah. And he's like, have you thought about doing stand-up? And I liked making people laugh, but I was never saw stand-up and was like, oh, that would be cool. So he was like, I was like, I don't know, I haven't thought about it. And he gave me some information. And he's like, UW has an experimental college. And then I signed up, and it was on UW campus. First, I spent like 4 or 5 months writing, nonstop, just writing and writing. Who knows why? I didn't know what I was doing.
So you've gone through your class. Now you're at Comedy Underground for your very first show. You're standing up there on stage. Like they call your name, you go up. All that's in your face are lights. Were you shaking? Were you breathing?
I was horrified. I paced back and forth. But yeah, so I did the set in front of a really supportive audience, and I was nervous, and I looked at the ground the whole time.
As you're mining your life to use for jokes, there's a lot of dark things that you've experienced. When do you get to the point where you're comfortable sharing that information?
Well, it goes both ways. Mm-hmm. There's stuff that I'm obviously not ready to talk about, and the audience can tell that. But there's also stuff that the audience isn't ready to hear someone be okay with. Nobody wants you to talk about your dead mom. That's...
Do you want to talk about your dead mom?
Yeah.
Why?
Because it's like a healing. It's like nice.
Do you feel like she would appreciate?
Yeah, she would have laughed at it.
Uh-huh.
She would think it's funny. We had Mother's Day, and we were hanging out together. And he scooted next to me to snuggle up to me, and I was like, this is really sweet. And he goes, Uncle Scott, can I ask you a question? I was like, sure, buddy, anything. He's like, your mom's dead, right? He's like, yeah. Is. No, I don't want to talk to you about it. You've been alive for 60 months. I don't think you have anything to add to the conversation.
When you're in a show setting and you've tried a couple of jokes that maybe most people aren't quite ready, but let's say the big laugh, they're the one that was like, that's what I've been wanting to hear. Do they come up to you afterward and share why it was important to them to hear that? And then all of a sudden you guys are sharing something?
I've had a couple. Yeah. Like I talk about my father. My dad's Mormon. So I'll talk about him and mm-hmm. what it's like growing up with like a Mormon dad. And I've had people be like, that's an experience I shared. Or it's like a highly specific experience
right.
that someone else shared. And I've had people come up to me and tell me, like, yeah, my dad was just like that.
Do they feel like they know you in some way?
Yeah. People tend to speak with you after shows like they know you. And it makes sense because you just gave them a lot of information.
Are there things that you will not ever joke about?
Yeah.
Like what?
There's been times when like I'll start telling a joke that's like, that's related to my mom. And then mm-hmm. I kind of feel, I'm like,
Have you gotten like emotional on stage like that?
No. Where,
no?
I get emotional thinking about little things. Like putting together like the vacuum cleaner she bought me when I moved out.
You wouldn't talk about that on stage.
No, it would make me cry.
Right.
I will cry.
Right.
If I talk about it. It hits like a moment. The vacuum cleaner represents a moment where I became weirdly aware that I was not in control of what happens.
So not in control of what happens with your life, and then when you go on stage, you're in control of everything.
Yeah.
Do those go together?
Yeah. I'm the master of my universe on stage.
Right.
In a world where it feels like, in a world where everything is out of, feels like could be out of control, I have this one thing that maybe like for like a half hour to an hour at a time, I get to orchestrate. At least in that time when I'm on stage, I know I don't have to be afraid.
That was 88.5's Ariel Van Cleve speaking with Seattle comedian Scott Lossy. Welcome back. This is Sound Effect on 88.5 KNKX. I'm Jennifer Wing. This week on the show, we're talking about TMI, too much information. And there are topics that most of us really do not want to discuss with our parents. Birth control is probably close to the top of the list. In this next story, Seattle writer Sarah Ann Lloyd tells us what it's like when she, her mother, and her grandmother talk about the pros and cons of diaphragms as easily as if they were out shopping for new shoes. And again, if you have young children who hear this story, they could end up having a lot of questions that you might not be prepared to answer just yet.
After years of bad experiences with birth control, at 19, I thought I had found the holy grail, the diaphragm. It was 2006 and nobody used diaphragms anymore. But I knew all about them, because since I was about 10 years old, I knew that my very existence depended on my mother leaving hers in the dresser drawer one cold winter day in January of 1986. I was conceived under the dining room table on the shag carpet of their Fremont apartment. "Be careful," she said, "you are a diaphragm baby." My mom is ordinarily one of the most gentle, accommodating people I know. She hates watching TV shows that use embarrassment as a plot device. She can't play Monopoly because she literally gives her property away. But she seems to get downright giddy when talking about real-life facts that would traditionally make people uncomfortable. Clinical facts. Sexual facts. So when I hit the why phase and started asking very specific questions about where babies come from, she was like, "Put me in, coach." This is how, at 4 or 5 years old, my favorite movie was The Miracle of Life. This is how, at 9, when my dad quit smoking and got into making balloon animals, I got really into making balloon sperm. And this is why, when my mom picked me up for winter break and we stopped at the pharmacy to pick up my diaphragm, she didn't give bringing my grandmother along a second thought.
Did either of you think that it was weird that you came along with me to get my diaphragm?
No.
No?
No.
I was thinking, oh, she's sexually active.
Do you remember when you asked me if I was having sex?
I have a vague recollection of bringing it up once because I was pretty sure that you were.
It was very short. It was just, "Sarah, are you having sex?" And I said, "No."
and it wasn't true?
Oh, I was definitely lying.
Yeah. I was more concerned that you were staying safe than I was concerned about you having sex.
Back at the pharmacy, my grandmother waited in line with me to buy my diaphragm. And as we waited, she had this advice. Never put your diaphragm in while you're menstruating. She ran into this problem on her wedding day.
Well, I had it all figured out. The date for the wedding was fine. I was going to menstruate about 2 weeks before the wedding, and I didn't. And so I started menstruating on the day I got married, which was really weird.
You also told me that story when I got my diaphragm for the first time.
Oh, did I?
Yes.
This was hardly my first conversation about anything sex-related with my family. In fact, for me, I started learning about as early as anyone could.
You were a rather precocious child, and I think you were probably 4.5 or 5 when you pinned me to the wall and said, "Mom, exactly what magical thing happens when mommies and daddies sleep together?" And so I went and I got a book at the library, and I read it to you, and I got to the part where it describes everything, and I read that really quickly, and you seemed to be okay with that. And I think that you felt like you could come and ask me if you had any questions.
Can you tell me a little bit about mom's sex ed growing up, Grammy?
Well, my brother, when he was growing up, he had gone to the library at the Indiana University, and he got a whole bunch of books and took them up to the librarian to check out, and she called my mother to make sure it was all right if he had the books, and she said it was. So when Karen asked the question, I thought, oh, this is the good thing. I'll just go and get some books at the library, and then she'll be able to understand all this. And I said to her, if you have any questions or you want to talk about this, just come to me. But she never did.
I got all the information I needed from that stack of books. That stack of books was fairly high. In fact, I became somewhat of a reference to some of my friends who would come up to me in school and say, "So I heard this. Do you know anything about this?" Because I knew a lot of stuff because I'd read the books. But I'm sure that it was augmented by what I heard around the dinner table. Families are different. In our family, we talked about sex.
Grammy, she needed those books. Her mother, my great-grandmother, sex, birth control, how babies are made, these were not discussed.
My mother, I wouldn't have talked to my mother about anything like that on your life, I don't think. I just didn't talk to my mother about things that were really important to me.
Was it conscious to do that differently with my mother?
Yes.
So you wanted to have a closer relationship?
I never knew what my mother would. She was kind of a loose cannon when it came to reactions to what you said to her, so you just didn't talk to her about things that mattered.
Did any of these early experiences have an influence on how you decided to communicate with mom about sex and her body and all of that?
No, I just like being open.
Maybe we're close like this because women are in short supply in my family. There are a lot of men.
So many men. You are the aberration. Society worries less about men knowing and talking about sex than it does women. And since most everybody on your dad's side and your mom's side are all men, it just was easier to talk about. We were easier to forget about.
I knew my mom, as a former nurse, had bred some degree of openness and anatomical know-how in me. But I don't think I gave any of the women who came before me in my family credit for the ethos behind everything. That when we know about our bodies and what they can do, we're able to care for ourselves better, and it can make it a little easier to move about the world inside them. Oh, and as far as my relationship with the diaphragm, it didn't last very long. It was not the holy grail of birth control. It was a pain in the ass to use. I switched to a copper IUD, which I still have, and yes, I discussed it with my mom.
That story from Seattle writer Sarah Ann Lloyd.
You're tuned to Sound Effect on 88.5 KNKX. I'm Jennifer Wing, and today we've been telling stories about too much information. And we close out the show with a story from Sound Effect contributor Alex Ashley in Bellingham. Alex has known his friend Kit for a long time. These two, they trust each other enough to share everything. All of the regular friendship boxes are checked, except one big box is empty. And they're okay with that. Alex has the story.
Dude, seriously, it is 6:09. You told me to call you right about 6 o'clock and you were not answering your phone. And in the meantime, there's a furry microphone in my face. So, call me back. Bye.
I've known my friend Kit since October 31st, 2012. 4 years and 3 months.
So do you remember why it is that we got in contact originally?
Whitney.
Back in 2012, a mutual friend tragically died. It was all over the news.
A crucial piece of evidence now in the hands of investigators working in the disappearance of Whitney Heichel.
Breaking news, a sad end to the search for a missing woman.
I attended the memorial in Gresham, Oregon, and the tragedy had affected the community in such a profound way that I wrote a little article about it, sort of a tribute to the family. I didn't know it at the time, but my article, shared among a few friends, began to circulate, and letters started pouring in from hundreds of people I didn't even know, just saying thank you for writing about it, I guess. Kit was one of them.
I mean, once the immediate thing with Whitney was done, I don't remember a period where we weren't talking. Am I remembering that rightly? Because pretty much once we started, didn't we just keep it going?
We've talked a lot. Like, Kit, I tried to scroll through some of these messages, and it was really tough to do.
Oh, they're huge.
There's a lot.
There's a lot.
I've never really figured out why we let it keep going. There was zero romantic attachment, nothing like that. And there's an age gap. Kit's in her 40s, I'm in my 20s. But over the past few years, we've covered a lot of topics. My estrangement from my father, my mother's drug addiction, financial difficulties, heartbreak. It was all there. In addition to being a journalist, I also spend a great deal of time on the road as a musician. So last time my band played in Seattle, Kit and her friends drove up from Portland.
And I look up and you're like 4 feet away and I'm like, oh, that's him right there. And she's like, which one? I said, the one in the football jersey. She's like, oh, he's tall. And that was, and she's like, are you going to go say hi? And I'm like, yeah, as soon as he's finished talking to this guy. And I'm like, okay, do I go up? Do I not go up? Do I go up? Do I not go up?
It's getting close to showtime. The theater's filling up and I send Kit a text like, where are you?
We're right there. This is one of the reasons it was so funny when you were like, well, where are you? Because right in front, right in the center for the whole show.
Wow, really? Did you tell your friends the whole story behind this, like before you guys came in?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, and then it was funny because I've, yeah, I'm like, okay, so here's the deal. We're friends. We've been friends for pushing 5 years. This is how we, you know, at least sort of introduced ourselves. But we've never actually met.
Ever. Not once. Not even for a second. In fact, this phone call is the first time I've ever even heard her voice.
So what am I supposed to go up and just, you know, tap you on the shoulder and be like, hi. Hi, I'm your online friend. You don't...
You should know this goes against everything I believe in about friendship. Communication's a big thing for me. Face to face, or at least over the phone so you can hear their voice. And sure, like anybody, I have a lot of contacts I don't know well in the real world. But in a friendship with somebody you've never met in the real world, is the danger sharing too much information or not having enough?
We craft who we are very carefully. You know, there's a lot of editing before you share with people. And I think it's a little easier to form an intimate friendship with somebody, you know, through the written word because you can edit it. At least at the beginning while you're still getting to know somebody.
Do you think that there's any part of that that is true now, even though we've been in touch this long?
I doubt it. I think at this point, there's very little that I would feel uncomfortable saying to you. And I'm pretty sure there's very little you would be uncomfortable saying to me. So that's a pro, that there's a comfort level there.
Do you think that... I don't know. Do you think that that kind of communication is more honest? Or do you think that maybe it's not as honest as, like, a traditional friendship?
I could see both of those being correct. My inclination is that it's more honest.
Really?
I think we hide an awful lot when we're sitting in front of somebody. The only way that I think consistently it's going to be more honest in person is through the nonverbal cues. Because unless you are a stellar actor, you're not going to be able to hide if something makes you flinch or, you know, something really surprises you or shocks you. I think, professionally speaking, you know, who you become when you set foot on stage is a lot more confident than I expected. You have a very diffident side to you where you shrug things off in the emails and the messages and things like that. It's not insecurity, that's not the right word, but I think I would have expected maybe a little more of that to show through. But you walked on stage and you were absolutely comfortable. It was a very, very strong persona.
That's interesting because, see, in my mind, that is an act. Because, like, when I go on stage, I'm very nervous and very insecure about, and I've got a million things going through my mind, and often I mask it with kind of a facade. Based on what you just said to me, the limited knowledge that you have of me just through the banter back and forth over the years, which has been completely text-based, is more accurate than the impression you got of me when you saw me in person for the first time.
As human beings, we run the danger that we are withdrawing too much from each other. And we could, you know, we could say it's just the times that we live in, but it's hard to say that it's just that.
There's an old proverb, you've probably heard it, that says absence makes the heart grow fonder. But what if that's all you ever have? Absence. What then? That night at the show, when the band left the stage and everything was over, I went out front and looked for Kit. She and her friends left before I could find them. We've still never met. But maybe someday.
That was sound effect contributor Alex Ashley. This brings us to the end of the show. Sound effect comes to you from producers Kevin Kniestad and Allie Ferguson. Aaron Hennessy is our executive producer. We get web help from Dave Nagaris. Parker Miles Bloom gets the word out on social media. Special thanks this week goes out to Will James, Ariel Van Cleve, Sarah Ann Lloyd, Alex Ashley, and Phoebe Flanagan. Our interns are Amanda Abbott and Addie Pratt. We'll be back next week when we head to Tacoma.
Literally, someone had to be murdered for me to update my website, and that seemed a bit much.
I'm Jennifer Wing. This is 88.5 KNKX.